The following presentation was recorded at the Newbury Buddhist Monastery, Victoria, Australia. Please visit our website at nbm.org.au.
So hello everybody, good morning, good afternoon, good night, good whatever, whatever it is for you, good death. I remember when I was a lay person sometimes watching Dhamma talks very, very early in the morning because I was from the Netherlands and I like to watch the Dhamma talks given in Australia. So the time difference can be up to 10 hours or something. So sometimes very strange times I was still watching Dhamma talks. So some of you may be doing the same. It's quite nice now with the internet. You can watch it, you can watch it live or you can even watch it later. I hear that some people sometimes they give compliments to monks like, thank you for giving that Dhamma talk, it helped me fall asleep. they listen to a talk to fall asleep. Well, that's not my intention today, to make you fall asleep today, because today I want to give a talk that inspires you and lifts you up instead of making you fall asleep. Because just before the talk, I asked Langdon, the one who's hosting, I asked him, what shall I talk about? And he said, talk about inspiration. And just last time I spoke at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, I had my talks very well prepared, with slides and everything, talking about mindfulness. But today I thought I'd do the total opposite, come totally unprepared and just see what Dhamma comes out naturally. And so I didn't really have a topic. I asked London, what shall I talk about? Inspiration, he asked. So then I thought, inspiration. That means I should give the best Dhamma talk, the greatest Dhamma talk in the world. So that's the title of today's talk, is the greatest talk in the world. Tribute. I don't know if anybody knows that song by Tenacious D, I think they're called. It used to be such a famous song when I was a young boy, and it was called the greatest song in the world. Tribute. And it starts like this. This is not the greatest song in the world. This is just a tribute. And it's such a funny song because they sing about how they can't give the greatest song in the world, but at least they can give a tribute to the greatest song in the world. So similarly, I cannot give the greatest talk in the world, but I can give a tribute to the greatest talk in the world. That was, and what is the greatest talk in the world? Well, to me, the greatest talk in the world, and I think to many Buddhists, the greatest talk in the world ever given was the first talk given by the Buddha. And the technical name of that in the Pali is called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. It means setting in motion the Dhamma wheel, which means starting the teaching and starting the dispensation, starting Buddhism in a sense. It all started with the single talk that the Buddha gave in the Deer Park at Isipatana, it's called. And actually, many Buddhist statues, they have a representation of this talk, like the one behind me here. I don't know if you can see it, but maybe it's behind the flower, actually. But you see, on below the Buddha, on the pedestal, there is depicted five monks. And they were the first five people to hear the Buddha's teachings. It was the Dhamma talk at the Dhammacakkappavattana at Isipatana. And there were only five people listening there. So a very small audience, yeah, the Buddhism would grow very big. And the greatest talk in the world, there were only five people listening. This is quite quite amazing, actually. But I suppose the talk was repeated many times. But there were five monks listening. And you see in the Buddha statue the wheel in the middle that represents the Dhamma wheel and was set in motion by the Buddha. So this must have been a very important talk. And what was it about? If it was the greatest talk in the world, but according to me, it was about the Four Noble Truths. Many of you will know. And you might think, oh, here we go again, the Four Noble Truths again. We know that already, Sunyo. But I think this is such an important teaching, and I keep coming back to it, and it keeps inspiring me so much, these Four Noble Truths. So yeah, today's talk won't be very original, because I'll just talk about Four Noble Truths, and maybe I'll mix in some other things as well. So when the Buddha was decided to teach these Four Noble Truths, before that he actually thought, shall I really teach this? Maybe nobody will understand what I'm saying. And he almost didn't start teaching. He almost just got enlightened and then was like, people won't get this. It's too counterintuitive, you could maybe say, or counter desire. And it's very deep, these teachings. And it takes a lot to embrace it and see them as they are. So the Four Noble Truths, I will summarize. In the first Noble Truth the Buddha started teaching, he said, the first Noble Truth is that life is unpleasant, is suffering, dukkha, he called it. Dukkha, he said, sickness you get in life, you get death in life, you don't always get what you want, and especially your body, yeah, you know, gets always tired and pain, and it's just a lot of problems in life. So life, the Buddha said, is problematic, is suffering. And you might think, well, we have a lot of problems now with COVID. That's, you might say, COVID, we should get rid of that. It's not natural. It's not the way life is supposed to be with this virus going on. But 2,500 years ago, the Buddha already warned us, saying, yeah, this is just the way life is. You know, sickness is part of life. Viruses, storms, and whatever have you, wildfires and everything, your loved ones passing away. It's all life. And it's problematic. That's basically the first thing that the Buddha says. And so far, maybe not too unique of a teaching, actually, because there's other religions who would maybe say the same thing, like, yeah, life is not so good. Yeah, it's actually a central tenet of other religions as well. So, but still, many people would not agree with that. Yeah, they would say, "Our life is beautiful. Life is amazing." And well, at some point, you kind of look at life and you say, "Yeah, life is beautiful. It's amazing." But the Buddha was saying, "There's always underneath everything." It's actually is not all that amazing. It's actually not the greatest the greatest peace, the greatest happiness that there can be. In one of the Dhammapada's verses, it says, "Nati kanda samo dukkha." And it basically, the kanda is basically what makes up life. So you could say, there's no suffering like life. Not, and then the next sentence is, "Nati santa mara, santi paramang sukhang." And that means there is no happiness, or there's no ease, just the same as peace. And actually was reminded of that because I just saw this picture of Ajahn Chah, and it has this phrase on there, Nati Santi Paramang Sukham. And the translation is actually pretty bad, actually, because it says there is no happiness greater than a peaceful mind. But the word mind, for those who know Pali, is actually not in there, you see? So actually, Nati Santi Paramang Sukham from Dhammapada actually means there's no happiness greater than peace. Santi is peace, and doesn't mean peaceful mind, because the Buddha said, not in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta per se, but in other suttas, that the mind is also suffering. Yeah, this is quite amazing. That even just to be aware, to know things is also suffering. Wow, that's very deep teaching. No wonder the Buddha was a bit hesitant to share it with us, that even a peaceful mind is still suffering, actually, because it's still things going on. There's still things going on. That is so difficult to see and so difficult to embrace, that even just awareness is still the suffering, according to the Buddha. So I'll talk a bit about how you get to see that later, but first you have to I remember this little story in the Jataka tales. Jataka tales are probably not original tales from the Buddha, but they are very inspirational anyway. And so there is this Jataka tale. There is a monk who, ordains, but then he disrobes again, goes back to his family life or lay life or whatever. Then he decides, I'll become a monk again. And then he disrobes again. And then, because he is tempted again back to the pleasures of the lay life, then he decides, I'll become a monk again. And then he is tempted by the pleasures again, and he becomes a lay person again. He disrobes again. Then he becomes a monk again. And he's like seven times he disrobes and gets drawn back to the sensual desires and back to the world. Then the Buddha says, I remember something similar happening in a past life. I don't know if it was the Buddha's past life or past life of that monk, but these Jataka tales are not real events anyway, so doesn't really matter. But then the Buddha tells this story about a gardener who has only one thing that keeps him alive. This farmer, actually, one thing that keeps him going is his very old and blunt shovel that he has. Because a farmer, yeah, you need a shovel at least, at the very least. But that's all this farmer had, the one shovel. With the shovel, he would, of course, toil the earth, then he would plant the seeds and wait for it to grow, and then he could take them out with the shovel and digging. And so he was very attached to the shovel, because this shovel was the farmer's livelihood. With this shovel, he was able to provide food for himself, sell some of the food, make some money. Yeah. So he was very attached to this one single thing, this one single shovel. But then that farmer decided to become a nun. Let's say it was a nun this time. In the story, it's always the monks just get a bit boring. So let's say the farmer was actually a lady, and she decided to become a monk, become a nun. So she put the shovel away somewhere safe, somewhere in a shed or something, and then went forth, put on the robes, ordained under the Buddha, not under the Buddha, ordained in a past life under a previous Buddha, maybe. And then, while she was a nun, she started thinking about the shovel again. And, of course, you know where the story is probably, where it's going. She disrobed and went back because she kept thinking of the shovel and how the shovel made her life, yeah, made her life work. And so she went back to the shovel, did a bit of farming again, and then decided to become a nun again. And when she was a nun, she disrobed again because she kept thinking of the shovel that she said put somewhere safe. And then she became a nun again, disrobed again, a nun again, disrobed again, a nun again, disrobed again, a nun again, and again, seven times she disrobed, or she became a nun. But the seventh time she was actually a bit more clever, because she decided, okay, six times I've been drawn back to the ley line because of this shovel. I should actually not keep that shovel safe. I should hide the shovel somewhere. I should bury the shovel, I think is what happened in the story. I bury the shovel somewhere where I forget about it, and then I won't be tempted to go back to the ley life. And so she gave up everything that she had and went, then became a nun and became enlightened. And that story sounds a bit silly, and of course that's the point of the story. Who is attached to a shovel? Nobody's attached to a shovel. But the point of the story is that we get attached to things that are not worthy of attaching to, and we should actually let go of everything. Not only shovels, but also much more subtle things that we are attached to. So we should let go of everything that there possibly is. We should let go of the idea of enlightenment even. Yeah? Let go of the idea of stream winning or whatever you hear about in Dhamma talks. And let go of the idea that you are gonna be the one who realizes things, because that's it's not the way things work. And we should also let go of the mind, to come back to that. Some point in your meditation you will reach this point, hopefully, that just momentarily you realize that, yeah, the Buddha was right with the first noble truth. It's all suffering, all the khandhas, including the consciousness, is all problematic compared to the absence of those things, compared to santi, compared to peace. Peace is the greatest happiness, santi paramang sukham. If you realize that and you let go of it all, you let go of all your old dirty shovels that you don't really need, then is the moment that you will realize the truth of these teachings. And these teachings are so weird, isn't it? And when the Buddha is talking about life being suffering, it might sound very depressing, doesn't it? Because we want the life to be pleasant, and then the Buddha comes, talks about suffering all the time, and it sounds very depressing. But you might notice that when I'm talking about suffering, I'm not depressed. Actually, I like talking about it. So how do we go about keeping a cheerful attitude in the light of this knowledge that it's all actually problematic? How do you do that? How do you keep inspired? How do you keep going? Well, one thing definitely very helpful is to actually also realize that it's not just all about suffering, because of course there's not just one noble truth that life is suffering. There's multiple noble truths, and there's also the noble truth that there is an end possible to suffering. And this is the third noble truth. I'm skipping the second one for now. The third noble truth is that there is a possible an end to suffering. And the fourth noble truth is actually saying, well, this end of suffering, you can practice towards. There is the Noble Eightfold Path to practice that, towards the end of suffering. And the Noble Eightfold Path includes this very important factors of virtue and also of meditation. So if you maybe feel a bit depressed about the Noble Truths, or just depressed about other things actually, then practice the virtue, practice being a good person, practice the generosity, and you'll actually get a lot of happiness out of that, because it uplifts the mind. And happiness and depression, those two opposites, they are not, in my experience, dependent upon the situation or that you're in, but dependent on the way you react to that situation. You might sometimes see people who are very sick, but still very happy. Whereas other people who are very sick get very depressed about it. What's the difference? Well, the difference is not in the sickness. The difference is in the attitude towards it, towards the sickness. The situation, external situation, is exactly the same, but internal situation is different. So it's the same with the sickness of life, in a way, yeah, the problem of suffering of life compared to the peace of Nirvana, is you can be depressed about it, or you approach it with a happy and energetic attitude. And the difference is just the way you look at it. Yeah, and but sometimes you cannot really change the way you look at things, because you're just too much a bit down. And as I said before, yeah, practice the generosity, practice the virtuous aspects of the path, but also do not forget about meditation. Because sometimes when you're not so inspired, maybe not so energetic, you don't really feel like meditating so much, because you think, I'm already not so uplifted. What good will the meditation do? I've been there, even as a monk. So then it's very easy to think, why meditate now? I mean, it's I don't feel on top of the world anyway, so it's probably I should do something else to distract me or whatever. But I find, actually, if you meditate regardless, then that is actually where you can get energy from the meditation. And when you get energy, you get joy. The two always go together. It's talked about in the suttas as well. So when you really meditate, even when you don't feel so well, you get uplifted. That's there you get energy. Then you can look at the Noble Truths as they are, because when you are depressed and you don't feel so well, then it's very hard to talk about or to look at the Noble Truths. But when you're uplifted and happy, this is the goal of meditation, and your mind is strong, then you can really look at these Noble Truths, which are very challenging. Yeah? But you can't do that unless you have a very, very strong mind. And I would even say you would have to really understand them, you would have to go into the really deep meditations of the jhanas. But that is a whole different subject I won't talk about too much today, because still have the other Noble Truths to go. I talked about the first Noble Truth. I talked about the third. Well, you already see how I was right at the beginning of this talk, that I cannot give the greatest talk in the world, because I'm already mixing things up and losing the thread all the time. So again, this is just a tribute to the greatest talk in the world. So yeah, the second Noble Truth I forgot totally about, so let's also talk about that one. And to talk properly about the second noble truth, we actually have to think about life in a broader perspective than just the one single life. It's a very important aspect in Buddhism that there is not just the one single life that we have. We are born before in other lives. We've had lives before as humans, maybe as also as other kind of beings, maybe as animals as well. And you have to keep this perspective in mind when you look at the Four Noble Truths. Because of course, when you just look at one single life, the amount of suffering is very limited. But if you look at it in a bigger perspective of having a whole cycle of lives, then things suddenly look a bit different. Because we get born again and again. And this is the problem. If we were just born once and that was we had a nice life and that was the end of it, then what would we be the point really of of the Buddha teaching us? Because in the end result would be the same for everybody. So the real point of the teaching. But that's not the way. That's not the way it is actually. And you can realize also that through meditation that no, you've lived before and you will live again. If you don't solve the causes of the rebirth. And this is what the second noble truth is about. The causes of a rebirth. And it says in the second noble truth, it's a craving that leads to rebirth. That is the cause of the suffering. It specifically says craving that leads to rebirth is the cause of suffering. Not just any craving, but craving that leads to rebirth. It's quite interesting actually. So if I crave for lunch, which will be an hour from now, I don't really crave for lunch, but if I would, then, well, that's not really what is part of the second noble truth per se, because it doesn't necessarily lead to rebirth, unless I will die before lunch and I'm still craving for lunch, then I might be reborn. Maybe as a kitchen deva or something. I don't know what I'm saying. But, you know, not all craving is per se a part of the second noble truth, because not all craving leads to the rebirth. Not all craving leads to the next life. And it's specifically this craving that leads to the next life that is, according to the Buddha, is the cause of suffering. Because once you are born, that's when you're, that's when you're bound to suffer, basically. That's when the problem starts. However, of course, as I said before, there's also a flip side of the coin. There's a solution to the problem, which is to end the craving. Yeah, and when you end the craving, and then you will end all craving, also craving for lunch. That is when there's no more force that leads you on after death to next rebirth. That is the point of the third noble truth. The end of suffering is set about when we end the craving. And it's not just that. No, it doesn't say in the noble truth that craving is suffering. Many people understand Buddhism in that way, that craving is suffering. But that's, if you read it properly, that's not what it says. It's not that it isn't true. Craving is also part of the suffering, but it's much broader than that. Yeah. And in the noble truth, you will see that craving, especially craving for rebirth, is the cause of suffering. It's not called suffering itself, although it's part of suffering. Yeah. So we have to eliminate the craving, and we have to let go of all desires. And as I said before, this includes the desire to be enlightened. This includes the desire to actually, the funny thing is, this includes also the desire to be free from suffering, because that's still a kind of a craving. So even the craving to be free of suffering, you have to also let go of to be able to to end suffering. So those are the four noble truths. First noble truth, that life is problematic, is suffering. The second noble truth is that the cause of this suffering, the cause of being alive, is that we get reborn because we crave it to be reborn, and craving sort of propels us onwards into next life. The third noble truth is that if we end this craving, then we can stop the suffering. Yeah. And the fourth noble truth is about the path that we can practice to remove all this craving and to then end the suffering. So that's the Eightfold Path. A very short version of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and a very not as nice version as the Buddha's. So I recommend everybody read the Sutta, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the one that I just gave a tribute to. So these teachings, they are, you might read them. Some people get really inspired by it, and other people maybe not. And some people might read them and immediately get some faith that this is true, that that there is such a thing as rebirth, and that is suffering. Whereas other people, they might read them and think, this is also silly, I don't have faith in this at all. Yeah? Because I was actually also asked somebody else, what shall I talk about, not just Langdon. And the other person, Richard, who lives here, and he said, maybe you could talk a bit about faith. So I'm trying to intertwine the two now into the talk. Inspiration and faith, very much connected, of course. But some people, they might read this teaching and not really have the faith in them. I know for myself, I did not believe in rebirth for a long time. Because it just sounded to me, it was a silly idea, to be honest, a long time ago when I was a lay person. Well, a long time, relatively 10 years ago or something, maybe a bit more. I thought it was a silly idea, rebirth. So I didn't have really faith in the Buddhist teachings at all, in these kind of things anyway. So how do you create that faith then? How do you rouse your faith? And there's various ways to do it. You could also decide to focus on other aspects of the Buddha's teaching that do inspire you more, that you have more faith. Maybe you might not have so much faith in these Four Noble Truths, but you have faith in the power of meditation. You have faith in the power of being a good person, or following the precepts of being kind and generous, these kind of things. And then it's very worthwhile to actually realize that the Buddha talked about these things also a lot. And basically, if what I'm saying is, if you have faith in a specific parts of Buddhism, and maybe not so much faith in others, then just focus on those things that do give you the faith and that do give you the inspiration. Because it's not always that all parts of the Buddha's teachings are as inspiring or as faith-inducing as all others. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha spoke so much. Suttas is different things for different folks, basically. How does the saying go again? Different strokes for different folks, or something like that. Different aspects of the teaching will be inspiring faith for different people. And you have to find your own things that inspire you. And there's also another way to increase faith. And then I would actually not use the word faith so much. Faith is a translation of the word sada, also can be translated as trust. But there is another term used in the suttas, which is, I can't recall now the exact Pali, but translation is usually something like confirmed confidence. And this is confirmed confidence means that actually you realize by direct experience the same kind of things the Buddha was teaching about, or that his disciples were teaching about, or that monks and nuns and like me are talking about. You realize these things for yourself, and that is another way to increase your faith, or also as it's called, confirmed confidence, because you confirm these different aspects of the Buddhist teaching. And that really, to me anyway, brings us back to the meditation and the insights you can get from meditation, the insights into the noble truth that it is, that life is problematic. How do you actually get to see that? You mean just hearing somebody talk about it may be nice to hear, but you don't really embrace it so much, especially when I said that the mind is also part of suffering. How do you see that? How do you see that life is suffering? It's by letting go of parts of the suffering. By letting go of the parts of the suffering, only then you can understand what the suffering is. When you're immersed in the suffering, you cannot understand what the suffering is, because it's just too close to you. You're just too normalized to it. And this, it's like the simile of the tadpole that grows into a frog. The tadpole, by the way, for people who may not be native English like me, is like this fish-like creature that lives in the water and grows later to be a frog. When you were a little boy, maybe you sometimes used to go fishing for them. I know many of my friends did, and they would keep them in a jar or something. But anyway, the simile of the tadpole is the tadpole lives their whole life in the water, surrounded by water. And they live inside of the water, and they think they know about water, but it's only when they grow up to be a frog and they go out of the water that they suddenly realize what they have been in all the time, because they can go out and look down upon the water. Then they can see what water really is, what they really have been living in all this time. And it's the same with the suffering. You have to move away from it for a little bit. You have to grow up to be a frog, basically. The frog that climbs outside of suffering. That's what you have to be. And this is what you do in meditation. You slowly move away from suffering. Or it may actually go very rapidly for some talented, or dare I say, lucky people, who just somehow fluke it, let it go. And you move away from suffering. First of all, the mind moves away from all the thinking that's going on inside our mind all the time. And when we usually live our life, we think a lot, and we think this is actually, sometimes we think it's a pleasant thing to do, all this thinking, and it helps us out. But when you actually move away from the thinking and you find the silence inside of the mind, that's when you can realize how this thinking is actually problematic. It was all this burden all the time. And now, well, you don't, if you think that, then you're suffering again. I think you get the point that when you are really peaceful inside, you're not thinking, and you actually can feel, experience how their thinking was suffering before. Whereas if you are still thinking about thinking being suffering, then you're still inside of the thinking, still inside of the suffering, and you don't really realize the problem to its full extent. You move away from the thinking, become quiet and peaceful inside, and then it doesn't stop there, of course. It goes much deeper than that. The mind eventually moves away from awareness of the body altogether and goes inside. This is what they call the jhanas. I don't want to talk about that today too much, but you let go of all the awareness having to do with the body. Then you get to see, this body was actually problematic. This body that I have been treasuring all this time, it's actually dukkha. It's not sukha, it's dukkha. It's suffering, not happiness. And the suttas talk about this as well, that you can only realize the suffering of the body by moving away from it. And this is like you are the frog that climbs outside of the water. When you move away from your body and you're just with the mind alone, that is when afterwards actually you can realize the body was suffering. Now, how would you know that even the mind is suffering then? You get the thread of this teaching by now, then you should know you should also move away from the mind. And this is when you let go of everything. And when you let go of it all, then the mind moves away from the mind in the sense that it just stops for a while. And you realize later, it was actually very, very, very peaceful. And actually, the mind is also suffering. And then you can move away from suffering. And that is one way to create a lot of faith and inspiration in the teaching by actually doing these steps of moving away from suffering and actually realizing that this was what the Buddha was talking about. And you're slowly getting out of the water, you're getting out of suffering, you're seeing actually these things happening. When you actually see, you're realizing these teachings bit by bit, that is when you can really get a lot of confidence that what the Buddha was saying makes a lot of sense. It's very pragmatic, also, the Buddha's teachings, compared to many other teachings that you might find, which just are based on belief. It's almost, the word religion and belief are almost synonymous in a way for many religions, but for Buddhism, belief is not something can be useful, but that's not the end goal. Yeah, that therefore faith is useful, but confirmed confidence is better. And that is the end. That is the end goal. Actually, realize teachings of the Buddha, and these things are possible. Actually, yeah, the Buddha was actually, when he thought before teaching the greatest talk in the world, when he thought, nobody's gonna understand this, he was actually very wrong. Surprisingly, the Buddha wasn't omniscient apparently, because he thought nobody's gonna understand this. But people did understand it. And actually, at the very first talk, the Venerable Kondanya already understood what the Buddha was talking about. And it seemed to even have surprised the Buddha. If you read the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha is like, wow, he understood. Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And it's still possible today. Some people are very, negative attitude. They might say, it's no longer possible these days to realize the Buddha's teachings. Too long ago the Buddha lived. But I say, no, this is all possible. And for those of you listening to talks like these, you have very good spiritual qualities. Especially if you made it this far into the talk and you're still listening, those few people out there who may still be listening, you, I have lots of faith in you that you can be the frog who gets out of the water. You can be the person who climbs out of the suffering. And you can realize and understand these Four Noble Truths, and you will be able to realize what the greatest talk in the world was all about. And that would be a true tribute to the greatest talk in the world. A true tribute would be not talking about it like I'm doing now. It's in a bit of a silly way. My apologies for that. But the true tribute would be to realize these Four Noble Truths. And when you realize them, then the end result is inevitable. You will actually get out of suffering. You will realize the Santi Paramang Sukhang. You will realize peace is the greatest happiness. And then you might be like this wonderful person here, Ajahn Chah, who many believe to have reached the end suffering, and I think you can all do the same. So I want to end my tribute there, and may you all thrive in the Buddha's teaching. Sadhu. So I don't know if there is any questions, then I'm happy to answer them. I don't have too much time before I have to go, but we'll see.
Thank you very much, Bhante, for your inspired and inspiring talk, the tribute to the greatest talk in the world. Yes. I didn't mention at the start that people can type their questions into the live chat here on YouTube. So if you do have a question for Bhante, please feel free to type that into the chat. Oh, someone's just posted one. And as Bhante said, he has a short time available. So we'll get through as many questions as we can. Would you like me to read the question out, Bhante?
I can read them myself, I think. I see him.
All right.
It's from Banana Eddie. Isn't it?
Bananacom.
Bananacom, Eddie. Oh, yes. The question is, how important is physical self-care, such as good hygiene and the appearance of nice, clean clothes? Is it just as important as meditation? And without it, can it affect the practice? Oh, the name is actually Ariel. Sorry for calling you Banana before, Ariel. No offense. So how important is physical self-care, appearance of nice clean clothes? Well, my clothes are actually not so, they're falling apart, my robe is actually. It's been tearing a lot, but I'm still wearing it because, you know, clothes is just the external part, and eventually your external, your body and your clothes will fall to bits anyway. Yeah. Even the Buddha, he was very wise and compassionate, but also his physical body at some point gave in. He got very sick at the end and also passed away. So this is one thing first to realize that, yeah, we can only do so much about the physical side of things. We can only sort of keep it up, do sort of the yearly maintenance like on a car, you know. you go to the maintenance with the car, but you know that eventually the car will have to go to the scrapyard. Man, I wouldn't recommend just yearly maintenance on the body. Do a bit more maintenance, yeah. Of course, it's important to take care of yourself. This is actually, it's important. So put it into the right perspective by realizing that eventually there's only so much you can do about the body. But yeah, it's also important. Care. This is actually part of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Before the Buddha teaches the Four Noble Truths, he said, don't go into two extremes or two ends of the spectrum. Don't go into too much sensual, pursuing the sensual side of life only. Yeah, if you're only about listening music, watching the soccer, and you don't care about the spiritual side of things, then the Buddha said, no, don't do that. Don't go into the sensual side of things. But also, don't neglect the physical side of things. Or how the Buddha worded it is, now, don't go into the self-harm, in a sense. Not the way we use self-harm nowadays, but don't think that by mortification or by just abstinence, not caring about the physical, that is somehow a good thing. No. The Buddha actually made it quite clear you have to also care of yourself. For example, the Buddha, before he got enlightened, he practiced the wrong path, and he tried to just eat as little as possible. He thought that would be a good thing at some point. But then he realized, just before he became enlightened, he realized, oh, that's actually not the right thing to do. I have to actually take care of myself. I have to actually eat properly. Otherwise, it is very hard to do the meditation. Yeah. So if you don't take care of your body, if you don't eat enough, if you don't take care of your physical health, don't take care of these kind of things, then your body will be affected and you cannot do the meditation properly because you're sick and starving and these kind of things. So Ariel, yeah, it's important to take care of your body. Please take care of your body. And can affect the practice in a good way. If you take good care of your body, then you will be easier to meditate. So thanks for that question. Yeah. I see there's another comment, which I will treat as a question, which is by Dizadil or something. Sorry. But this person says, at the time of the Buddha, some people got enlightened just by listening to the Dhamma. Well, I want to comment on that, because that is actually not what I think happened. Because when you read the suttas, then the Buddha always says, how do you get enlightened? Is by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. And also, how do you even get to this thing called stream entry when you understand the Four Noble Truths? It's also by doing practice in accordance with the Dhamma. And also, practicing a spiritual path, including meditation. So it's not just that you listen to a talk and you get enlightened. It doesn't work like that, because you might be a tadpole underwater listening to the best Dhamma talk ever, but you still won't understand, because you actually have to climb out of the water, as I talked about before, to realize what water is. So you have to actually get out of the suffering to understand what suffering is. So when the Venerable Kondanya at the first Dhamma talk of the Buddha understood what the Buddha was talking about, it means that he actually let go of all the suffering. And he actually, the Buddha's talk triggered his letting go. It triggered him getting out of the suffering for a little bit. And he must have practiced meditation before, because he was already a renunciant, yeah? Just like the other four bhikkhus at the time. They were already practicing various kind of meditations and stuff. So he wasn't unprepared. And it's the same in all many other suttas. It's actually, I would say you always have to practice before. It's not just happens out of nowhere. So thanks for that question. I hope I answered it appropriately. I could go into many more suttas. I could give a whole talk about it, but I just want to keep it a little bit brief, because I see there's actually some other questions coming up here as well. One is by Brett. Oh, computer issues. What am I doing? Here we go. By Brett. First he said, thanks Bhante. Well, thank you Brett for thanking. And thanks for listening as well. As a beginner, there seems to be an overwhelming number of suttas. Is there a map of where to start? How to go through them? Yeah, there is a lot of suttas. Yes, I know that. I know. Yep. When I was a layperson and I first was interested also to just read a few suttas, I looked up online and I hadn't got a clue about all these texts. And exactly, there seemed to be so many. So I wanted to read them in Dutch. So I went on the Dutch website where you can buy books, and I typed in Suttas Buddha, and then all these books showed up, and there were different titles. And one was The Long Discourses by the Buddha in Dutch, of course. Yeah, I can't remember what the exact Dutch was, but. And The Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha, The Numbered Discourse. And then there was also a book called The Short Discourses of the Buddha. And of course, I thought, that's the one I need to get. The short one is good. Because just keep it short and simple, I thought. So that's the one I bought. And it's still in the Netherlands, actually, with my brother. I don't know. Maybe he'll read it one day. But that was not the best place to start, because the short discourses are actually mostly some verses and stuff, and not the best place to start. There is some anthologies of the suttas. Anthologies means like they collected different texts together. And that's probably the best place to start, because you get a kind of an idea of what these suttas are all about. There is, for example, The Word of the Buddha is an anthology by Ñanatiloka was his name, I think. Bhikkhu Bodhi also had has an anthology of the sutta, I think, maybe called In the Buddha's Words or something like that. Yeah. So look up things like that instead of just plunging into the suttas. See if you can find some sort of guide or anthology to the suttas. That will be helpful to get you started. But you can also start, of course, jump straight into the suttas. And which sutta is the best one to start with, according to me? Of course, you listen to the talk, you'll know it's the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the setting in motion the Dhamma wheel, or the wheel of Dhamma. And that is from Samyutta Nikaya 56.11, I think. But if you just Google setting in motion wheel of Dhamma, then you'll probably find that sutta very easy, and that's a nice place to start. SuttaCentral.net is a good website with decent translation by Venerable Sujato that you can read. I'll recommend that website. So Brad, I hope that helps. And here we have another question by Christy. Would the merits of reaching nirvana also help my family and maybe the members of my family that passed on? I would definitely say yes to that. Yes. The best way to repay our parents or our family, according to the Buddha, is to inspire them and induce faith in them. Get confidence in the Buddha's teaching. Because these Buddha's teaching, they are what lead away from suffering. And isn't that what we all want in the end? We want to move away from suffering, yeah? We want to be happy. Why? Because we want to move away from suffering. That's actually what we want. So that's what all your family actually wants. They want to move away from suffering. And if you yourself are able to do that, then that's the best way to inspire your family to do the same, to also look into these teachings, to be a good person, to meditate, to practice generosity and all these things. So, and also family members that passed on, well, they have, may have passed on, but as in Buddhism, we believe in rebirth, so they're not gone forever. Yeah, they're still about somewhere. And they may actually be paying attention to what you're doing. Might very well be the case. So if you reach, maybe not nirvana per se, but just be a good person, etc., then they will notice and they'll be inspired and uplifted. So that's a great thing to do, definitely. Yeah. So I see there's more questions coming up. I've got time for one more, because I can notice through the windows the monks are already putting their robes on to go to lunch in a moment. So I will have to join them, but I want to not disappoint Isaiah and also answer his question. Bhante, what was your experience training as an Anagarika? Anagarika is a tradition we have in the monasteries here in Australia and also in many other places, is that you don't immediately become a monk when you join the monastery, but you stay a layperson for a while who lives in the monastery. That's what we call anagarika. Anagarika literally means somebody who doesn't have a house, yeah, who doesn't live in their own home anymore, but they live in the monastery. And what was my experience? I could talk about. That's a good subject for a talk, maybe. But overall, my experience was very, very happy. And actually, to be honest, there has been times as a monk that I thought, "Oh, I wish I was still an Anagarika." That may be surprising, but as an Anagarika, it's so easy to help out the monastery and the monks. And it's such a great gift to be able to, for example, make the lunch for the monks, to cook for them and give them their requisites, do things for them that they can't do because of their precepts. And that gave me so much happiness. And I still remember, for example, giving them the rice, and thinking back on that, reflecting back on that, still gives me happiness to this day. Remember also with the robe offering ceremony as an Anagarika, then we have this big ceremony in Bodhinyana where I usually live. Maybe thousands of people come, or more than 1,000 people come at the end of the range retreat, and people offer robes to the monks. And all the other Anagarikas at the time, they were just, because we had to do a lot of work on that day as well, like guiding the traffic, cleaning up, etc., etc. Most of the other Anagarikas during the robe offering, they were just chilling and just keeping away from the crowd, basically. But I thought, this is my opportunity to give a robe to the monks. And I remember very well doing that, taking these robes and offering them to the monks, going into the crowd and giving the robes. Actually, one of the monks who is here with me right now, Venerable Bodhidharma, is one of the monks that I gave a robe to as a Nainagarika. This is what brings me so much happiness to think about. But yeah, also had a lot of great meditation as well as in Nainagarika, and lots of very insightful moments, let me put it that way. And a lot of interesting experiences that go just beyond the normal offering of robes. So, because living in a monastery, get the opportunity to really go deep inside your mind and really learn about yourself, which can be challenging. Actually, it's also challenging as an Anagarika and as a monk as well. It's definitely not the easiest of lives, but it's very interesting anyway. Your tadpole growing its legs, let me put it that way, as in any character, which is a weird thing to grow legs. You haven't had legs all your life, so it's a weird thing to do. Always very much respect for all the people who are Anagarikas and other lay people living in a monastery. It's a special way to live your life, not the easiest. Because in a way, the monks and the nuns get all the respect in the monastery, but the Anagarikas do a lot of the work, and the monks also. But you don't get as much respect. So I definitely do have a lot of respect for Anagarikas because I've been there. I know what it's like. But if you are considering this, Isaiah, to try out the Anagarika life, then I would definitely say, give it a go. Don't hold back, because this is your chance to try, and you can always just have a taste of the Anagarika life, and it gives you also a taste of the monk's life. So I will hope that gives you a little bit of an answer of what it was like. Yes, I'll leave it at that. So thank you, everybody. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. For listening to this talk, and I will sorry to say that I am leaving this monastery very soon, because I'm going back to Bodhinyana. Now the borders of WA, Western Australia, are open again, semi-open, so I'll be going back there. And yeah, it's been a good time here in Newbury. I want to thank everybody of the BSV for supporting me, all the people who have come to give us food, donations, all the people who have made this place a possibility. Thank you so much. And maybe I'll come back.